ChatGPT is the fastest growing app in history. You guys got to 100 million users in basically 2 months after launch. So do you remember when you guys had to put up that, you know, we're at capacity page?
So that was on Thursday. It was the day after, actually. I think actually OnCall ended up getting woken up in the middle of the night as things started to ramp. First, and as Asia woke up, and then as Europe woke up, and then as North America woke up. It just kind of hit viral Twitter news cycles.
Welcome to The Edge of Infinity, a podcast of builders talking to other builders in the AI space. Together, we discuss where the field is at today and make predictions about how things are going to look like in 5, 10, 100 years' time. I'm your host, Lena Avancini-Colucci. Thanks for joining me as we imagine the future of AI together. In this episode, we talk with Evan Morikawa, who leads applied engineering at OpenAI. OpenAI is one of the most important companies in the world today. They are certainly on track to be one of, if not the very first inventor of AGI or artificial general intelligence. And Evan is on the productization side of OpenAI. So once a model has been developed by the research team and then passed through the safety team, it gets handed off to Evan. And what Evan and his team do are everything from front end to back end to the APIs to user accounts to GPU clusters and Kubernetes deployment, essentially everything that you and I interact with when we use one of OpenAI's products. And OpenAI has very recently divided up into two teams, but at the time of launch of ChatGPT and DALL-E, all of the applied engineers at OpenAI reported to Evan. I have so many favorite moments from this conversation, but my top three are first, us talking about AGI, Evan's definition for it, and how we know we'll get there. I've never heard that definition before. Second is Evan's advice for balancing kids and career. I learned a ton. And finally is what Evan has learned from Sam Altman. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Evan. Evan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by talking about ChatGPT. So ChatGPT is the fastest growing app in history. You guys got to 100 million users in basically 2 months after launch. And then by comparison, it took TikTok, I think, around 9 months, Instagram, 2.5 years. So you guys got to that user number, you know, fastest by far. And so let's rewind back to launch day. You know, it was Wednesday, November 30th, 2022. What was that day like for you?
I mean, we were definitely watching out for things. So I would say that we had no one knew exactly how this was going to go. We knew we were doing some things differently that worried us a little bit. One was that there was no wait list at launch. You know, with other products, we've had a wait list before, both because of safety reasons, also because of like load and capacity reasons. This time we wanted to make sure that we could get access as wide as possible. And that's right there in the like broadly distributing the benefits clause of the charter here. But at the same time, really the only mechanism we had was we had this like we are at capacity page that we could throw up if things started to run out of steam there. The other thing too was that this was designed to be a fairly, not necessarily a huge product launch, but kind of a test of some of the new features that we had, notably a new kind of chat-based UI, as well as a fine tune of our GPT 3.5 model that was more optimized for chat. So in a lot of ways, in some perspectives, not a ton was changing. You know, there was a slight UI difference, a model that if anything was better aligned with kind of more on the rails chat conversations. I actually think on launch day, there actually wasn't a ton of traffic. I actually don't think it even like passed number 5 on Hacker News that day at all. Yeah, no, the launch day itself was fairly tame. We tried to provision a little bit of extra capacity over there, but I don't think a ton beyond that.
Fascinating. Do you remember when you guys had to put up that, you know, we're at capacity page?
So that was on Thursday. It was the day after, actually. I think actually on-call ended up getting woken up in the middle of the night as things started to ramp. First, and as Asia woke up, and then as Europe woke up, and then as North America woke up, it just kind of hit viral Twitter news cycles first about things, and then started to take off from there. And we were like very quickly watching kind of the traffic rise for things, as was the case for unfortunately quite a while. The primary limiting factor for us are the number of GPUs that we have to serve these models. So once everything was saturated, we were kind of like forced to throw up that we are at capacity page, which unfortunately prevented people from signing up anymore for quite a while, actually, shortly after that launch, until we could try and make a lot of improvements there to try and get more people on.
Yeah, the hottest gossip in Silicon Valley right now is who has GPUs and who's getting new kind of shipments and allocations of GPUs when, right?
That's right. Yes, that continues to this day for sure. These are definitely a very precious commodity right now.
So from the outside looking in, engineering at OpenAI, from my perspective, was probably a pretty normal job up until last year, to all of a sudden incredibly stressful, probably with like ChatGPT being that like transition point. Is that what it feels like from the inside? Like what's been?
No, I would say it's always been a little different. So first of all, the engineering parts, our applied group, which is the group broadly chartered with taking this crazy technology and safely bringing it to the world, kind of looks, feels, and acts like you would expect a product-minded startup to do so. In fact, nearly everybody, a vast majority of all the engineers on this team do not have machine learning backgrounds. The skills here are very much about building good apps and good experiences and building like resilient distributed software and infrastructure and things like that. So that is something we've been heavily indexed on for quite a while, including today as well too. And there have been a series of increasingly larger launches that the team had dealt with before handling ChatGPT that I think helped us a little bit. Actually, I think the first big launch that we did was in concert with GitHub when they launched GitHub Copilot. We were heavily involved with that launch there. And then the other thing that happened was DALL-E, when we launched that for the first time through hosting the image generation pieces as well. That was sort of yet another sudden like surge of interest and traffic when those very first image generation models came out.
Interesting. So from the inside, it kind of feels like it's just been a steady kind of ramp. You know, it's kind of... Nothing has felt too crazy because you're always just kind of continuously ramping up.
I don't know if anything ever can feel not crazy sometimes. but yeah, in terms of us continuously like ramping up scale here, there's definitely a lot.
Interesting. So just to give the audience context, so you are engineering manager at OpenAI. What is your role? What does it entail? What do you and your team do?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now I manage several of our engineering teams, notably the kind of API, the core inference stack, a lot of our infrastructure. So basically everything it is to sort of be this platform that serves all of these models at scale at this point. A lot of it has been seeing this team grow from the beginning until where we are now. When I joined OpenAI in October of 2020, there was just the very start of an applied team. The whole applied team started that summer of 2020 when GPT-3 first came out, which is really the first time we were exposing any of these models as like a product or an API to anybody like that. So then I took over the team shortly thereafter and been continuing to like steadily grow applied engineering since then. But now we kind of have several different product verticals. We effectively have ChatGPT, which is this end user application that we have, our API layer that now powers lots of other companies and businesses using AI as well. And that all sits on this large fleet of GPUs that serve inference.
So you were telling me at the time, so last year, you guys recently split up into these different product teams, but at the time of launch of ChatGPT and DALL-E, all of engineering was reporting into you.
Yeah, that's right. It was a much smaller team, mind you, as well, too. There were only a couple dozen of us when DALL-E launched, and not that much more when kind of ChatGPT got going as well, too. Now, I should note that this is while, yes, that is a fairly small team in terms of the engineering size, none of this is possible without all of the fundamental research that went into like building and training these models as well, too. So I say there's a large majority of, or rather a large chunk of researchers that we have that are constantly fine tuning and tweaking the models there. A lot of these projects start as early research ideas and then get a little bit like hardened and productionized as we wrap a product around them too.
The kind of capabilities and kind of roles that are under you, I mean, is it all of infrastructure, it's like front end, back end, like all of that is
yes, right now it's a pretty wide scope. I think mostly due to the fact that we have a fairly, like I said, it's still a fairly small team and product right now as well. Although getting bigger all the time, this has been certainly a major focus of mine as well. Yes, but we the applied is also the side that has currently been spending the most effort building inferencing infrastructure. There are separate groups within a research org that specialize in building the large training clusters that train these large language models. This is a slightly different problem, though, than running inference at scale. You know, when you're a large training cluster, you need every node to talk to every other node, and everybody needs to take a gradient step at the same time together. And do so with like huge batches of data flowing through. At inference, we do share many of the same problems. These models do not fit on a single GPU. We have a lot of the complexities of coordinating across GPUs. But nonetheless, we're about serving like highly reliable, low latency, heterogeneous sort of workloads of everybody's different requests coming through the app. And while ChatGPT is certainly a huge chunk of that traffic, these GPUs are also serving a lot of the API traffic coming through that powers a lot of other people's apps and applications too.
Just to ask, so for you and your team, like what has been the craziest time during your tenure so far at OpenAI?
Probably the weeks after ChatGPT launch, certainly I would say are one of the crazier times as well. It certainly impacted some teams harder than other for sure. The kind of core engineers that were supporting what at the time was some very new infrastructure to serve ChatGPT. We're constantly just, like going from one fire to the other at that point. I think this is more an exercise of picking which fires to let burn at the time to try to like keep up with demand. There were simultaneously a lot of efforts to try and move things around to get more capacity here, and capacity for us is really in terms of more anything we could do to get more GPUs to serve more traffic, while also making a lot of big pushes to try and squeak optimizations that we could out of this. You know, if you make inferencing or you make the system 50% faster, from our perspective, that was the key to serving 50% more people with the same amount of hardware, roughly speaking. But yeah, that was another like kind of major focus of things there too. You know, at the same time, when ChatGPT launched, been also actively working on preparing GPT-4. So in addition to just stabilizing ChatGPT, we were getting ready to launch GPT-4. Plugins also came shortly after that as well, too. So we're also kind of simultaneously prepping for that. So yeah, that was a particularly busy time.
Did it surprise you? I mean, ChatGPT had this crazy kind of impact on the world, right? And then GPT-4 came out a few months later. And when I use it, I mean, I think it's an order of magnitude better, right? The reasoning capabilities are insane, GPT-4 compared to 3.5, but it didn't have as much of a splash on the world. Was that surprising for you?
Yes and no. So I would say internally, we were certainly excited about GPT-4. I think it's partly because, you know, everyone had kind of gotten used to what GPT-3 could do as well. One thing I think we underappreciated certainly is I think a lot of people here forgot that magical feeling that they felt really all the way back when GPT-3 first came out. Like, everybody here also kind of had their minds blown about this thing that you could like talk to in coherent ways. And for a lot of people with ChatGPT, it was not just their first exposure to a newer, better model. It was their first exposure to this type of like AI interface at all. And yeah, it is a little bit subtle sometimes, the differences between where GPT-4 shines and where GPT-3.5 doesn't. That's something that that's been emergent and developed over time. And we can see it in evals and then lots of different types of like places and conversations. But yeah, but like there are lots of types of questions you can ask both models, and they both give a seemingly totally reasonable response to. So the differences are certainly subtle in some applications and black and white in other applications.
There was this really cool moment where Lex Friedman talked about you in his podcast episode with Sam Altman. And I think I texted you after. I was like, I just heard Lex talk about you. You put out this tweet and then I think provided him with even more information about OpenAI and kind of the pace at which you guys ship. And maybe it's in response to criticism you've heard that like, hey, OpenAI doesn't ship. And so you put out this tweet of like, here's the play-by-play of when we've shipped what. And it's a really impressive cadence and clip. What I wanted to ask is, what's the balance to strike between shipping and then doing R&D? Like, when do you know that something is ready to go out the door?
First of all, these are all happening in parallel. If anything, there is far more stuff that the research teams have that we just like haven't shipped yet, frankly, mostly due to our focus and bandwidth and availability to do so. But yeah, the despite things like coming out at quite a heavy cadence here, nonetheless, by far one of the primary like things that holds us back and make sure that we do very carefully is a lot of the safety work ahead of time to make sure that we are shipping something at a state that we know is good enough and ready to go out. Feeling like the safety systems, like the alignment work isn't quite there yet has been by far the single biggest reason why anything has like shipped later than it would have otherwise. So there's a lot of effort to try and make sure that like happens. OpenAI's ability to like continuously put out new interesting things, that is actually the main thing that like piqued my interest to join 3 years ago at this point. I remember just pulling up the blog from the first 5 years of research land and being like, how does one tiny organization continuously like clockwork just like put out more and more like groundbreaking research like this with a fairly like small group of people? Yeah, and then being able to like continue that forward and continue to do so as we grow, if anything, despite us growing, is I think going to be one of the biggest challenges going forward too.
I mean, it's a great question. How do you guys do it? How does such a small group of people consistently put out so much impressive work?
There's definitely not one silver bullet for sure. I mean, Sam Altman is very insistent on what you can do with like extremely high talent density. I think that is definitely a big part of it. Having a small team of very talented people with a lot of autonomy like helps a lot. This was actually something we intentionally had thought through in the way we set up our teams. ChatGPT is intentionally set up as a bit more of an kind of independent autonomous unit as a result to try and emulate that kind of speed you can get when you are a 8-month-old kind of early stage startup right now too. The other thing that though at the same time is hard to ignore is the, I would say unlike the other smaller earlier stage startups, it still has this like incredibly well-oiled research machine, like this huge litany of advances that have been piling on top of each other for years and years and years and years. That's certainly a huge piece of this. and all the infrastructure that was like kind of put in place to make that happen.
Interesting. So hire really, really, really smart people, get a lot of them in the same room, and then kind of let them have at it.
That's certainly a huge piece of it. Yes. Trying to push as much as possible into that early startup playbook as possible what can we do to kind of like capture that, the type of speed that you get when you're sort of an early stage startup. Yeah. We know that is hugely important. This is an increasingly hyper competitive field right now. All of the titans are bearing down as hard as they can to do things now too. Certainly something that helps us a lot, I would say too, is a bit of a greenfield nature with which we can come into things. You know, we're not worried about cannibalizing an existing like search product. We're not worried about cannibalizing some other aspect of the business that shareholders are going to be asking hard questions about later. Like, these are very real effects that can stack up against you.
I'm curious, is there anything else you've learned about running a company from Sam Altman?
Sam is probably, I don't think I've really seen anybody think quite so ambitiously as Sam and like really mean it. Like at all points, at basically every all hands here, there is some very sci-fi sounding vision being pitched at any given moment, but everybody here is dead serious about it. Like this is not framed as the stuff of fantasy. This is like framed as, yeah, something we're just going to really go on and like push for and do and like think bigger about. I can't say I've seen anyone who's like really been able to like think bigger about it and then go execute it, but also do so in like a very empathetic and like humbling way. He's also an incredibly, like, he will like listen to the people around him as well. I think he like is actively aware of the information bubbles. I do not get the impression that he's kind of often. I feel like there have been some personalities in tech leadership recently who are in a little bit of their own headspace and can't seem to get out of it. But yeah, there's a certain amount of grounding that he's been able to hold on to as well.
Yeah, which is impressive, right? Because, I mean, I think we all get into our own bubbles, and it's hard to realize when you're in a bubble and how to get out of it. And it's interesting to hear that you think he's been able to tap into that. And it sounds like beyond, I mean, he went on the kind of world listening, right? But it sounds like even before that, right, it was like within the team being able to have an ear.
I think that's a great example. I mean, it was just the sheer like impetus to do that in the first place, right? It is about like being connected to that. I actually think that, if anything, is like a very like existentially important part of OpenAI. You know, the charter here is about benefiting all of humanity here. And there is a very like acutely aware major section of the company that like absolutely understands that we like live in a very pluralistic society here. You not live in this one Silicon Valley bubble, and being able to like actually do that on all of the like many dimensions you need to, like, needs different ways of thinking, needs different ways of like going out and connecting with like other parts of society in the world here.
You've started a couple of startups before. So you've been a founder. How is being a founder different from being an employee?
Here, frankly, not that different. Certainly a lot less stressful, that's for sure. I mean, let's be clear, like OpenAI is very well positioned here to like give security for the places that are helpful for sure. But at the same time, this has been a very active profile that we looked for when hiring for. The ability to take a quite vague problem, this kind of new technology, and just figure out a solution around to it end to end has been a huge and major component of what makes this successful. Now, this is, as the projects are becoming even more like large and varied and complex, we do need a large set of skills. We both have people here who are multiple time YC founders that are great at going off and like prototyping some new piece. But we also have people here that have seen all the big company infrastructure scaling problems and like really can like set us up for a level of scale that most early stage startups just like don't see. So we need a bit of a balance of both right now, but that type of like creativity and ownership and just willingness to dive in and do whatever and take agency over things are deeply important values that we have. And I think one of the key successes, one of the key like reasons behind any amount of like success we can claim.
Is having been a founder something that you look for when hiring people, or how do you, you know, there's many ways to kind of be able to take initiative and go from that zero to one without being a founder, but
that's right.
Is that something you actively look for when you're hiring?
Yes and no. I mean, it is definitely like a sign that can add on to other things as well. It very much is the case that if, the environment here is rapidly changing. There are not the major structures that are in place of like a large, of a large company. At the same time, I have had people who have, you know, on paper had nothing but giant FANG company like careers, but have been able to at every stage, kind of like through their own volition and initiative, like carve out significant areas and push to run on that as well too. So I think that personality type does show up in kind of early stage founder pieces, but it can also show up elsewhere too. If anything too, I would say that on the flip side, the counterbalance here is that the having, like we are also ourselves a company, like growing up a little bit more too at this point. We are at a scale where if someone has only seen the earliest stage startups or only like hackathon something together, unless you've also had the experience sort of seeing a lot of these robust systems at scale, that is also a difficult gap to close. So it kind of depends. But nonetheless, in general, I think that is like a pretty strong sign of just like a willingness to, if anything, jump into the void and do whatever is necessary to make something happen. So it's a pretty good leading signal in that sense.
You had a role in putting out GitHub Copilot into the world. Do you use it regularly? And how is it going to change the coding experience as you're hiring SWEs in the next couple of years? What are engineers going to be doing? And how will that experience be different or the same than it is today?
Yeah, it's a big question. GitHub Copilot was an interesting... Actually, that was very significant for us internally as well. That was really one of the first times that a lot of people were like actually dog fooding our own stuff. You know, the earliest versions of GPT-3, people could like play games or write poems, but like no one was like using it day to day in work. Copilot was the first time that people were like, oh yeah, I'm like, this is like, I can feel myself being a little bit more productive here. It was the thing that finally got me off of Vim onto an IDE. I still use Vim key bindings on VS Code, but I was like, okay, this is, I guess, worth it now. So
you transitioned to VS Code.
Yeah. So there's at least that. Yeah. Now there are still like, a large set. There's a huge space here around what it means to be like productive. I think the way Copilot started, right, this kind of like autocomplete plus is really just the tip of the iceberg. I know a lot of people, GitHub themselves, are working on systems to write your test for you, refactor your code, like do a lot of the like kind of toil work. Like this should lead to big productivity jumps soon. I think the big one that we have yet to really see, like bits and pieces of and prototypes, but nothing like that we've like really viscerally felt yet, is, you know, like it knowing deeply about all of your code, being able to like put the entire private repo in context or through retrieval or through some mechanism here should feel like a major step function in productivity here as well too. Yeah, I think software engineers though is a place where it's difficult to I am personally quite bullish on the future of this as a career. If there's any place that has been adaptive to increasing levels of automation, it has been software engineering. Maybe it's a little bit more extreme than the days we introduced like compilers over assembly, but nonetheless, maybe it'll be as similar for like a productivity jump.
Yeah. I mean, if we project first of all, Copilot is amazing. It makes me so much more productive. It always blows my mind where sometimes I can just enter in like three characters and it just writes like an entire function that's exactly what I want it to be doing. And it doesn't yet have the whole context on the whole repo, right? But because you kind of work on features kind of in concert and at one time, and it has that in its context window, it feels like it does. So I'm personally blown away by the product. I'm excited about it just getting exponentially better over time. What is a software engineer going to be doing in 50 years or 100 years? Like, what does that job look like?
Oh, 50 or 100 years. That's pretty far in the future at that point. I think there are some things that will, at least for now, seem to very much be human problems. I mean, if you think about just like the career advancement of software engineering in general, right? As it gets towards the higher levels of software engineering, you suddenly realize this is less a code problem and this is more a like human problem. This is a product problem. This is like a design and architecture problem. With kind of, let alone 50 years, with the next year or two of automation, I hope that like, I think that we will see that the level of abstraction with which we need to work will like change and evolve over time. 50 years is considerably far past, I think, the current industry's median for super intelligent AGI. So to me, that's sort of synonymous with guessing what the world will look like then. Yeah, so the profession should definitely look and feel different. I think anything that like has these types of kind of like automated processes, the computers like being able to code and check themselves and try again and like do something new, like they'll be able to do that. Now, whether or not how we find the equilibrium of like who's directing the higher level goals here, that, yeah, we'll need to see where that goes.
Well, this is a great transition into, is GPT-4 AGI?
Oh, I do not consider GPT-4 AGI yet.
How will we know when we're there?
Yeah, so we actually talk about AGI as an intelligence that's roughly is economically productive, is kind of the average human here, which is different than super intelligent systems. And it is also on the other side, different than something that can like very much like transform the way that we work. I think GPT-4 plus a lot of the things that we have planned over the next year can definitely be transformative in the way that we work. I think we're approaching the point that we're asking a similar question to like, at what year did the cell phone become disruptive? And what year did the computer change things? It is clear that it has. Now, it is possible with the compression of those timescales that we will go through that transition so fast that it might effectively feel like a year in which that happened. So you might actually be able to do that. But nonetheless, I think kind of as you zoom in closer, it will look and feel more like this gradual, if not quick, transition. This actually is significant. This is as opposed to, say, I personally do not believe anymore in the like turn it on singularity moment that has certainly pervaded and might still exist in a lot of the kind of rhetoric around this as well too. Even if there is a system that can like rapidly improve upon itself very quickly, there's still some amount, like I said, the time frames can continuously get compressed. One thing that I think that will not move as quickly though is just like human and society's like fundamental pace at which it like adapts to new situations and new things has a certain floor to it. Even in the face of like a very powerful technology, there's the like rate at which that we can like adapt to it and integrate it into society, integrate it into the way that we're working.
Even if we have this, you know, gradation of, you know, it's not a singularity and all of a sudden there is, you know, AGI of a superhuman intelligence scale, there's got to be a point somewhere along that gradient, right, where we say this was not AGI and now it is. I mean, push back. Do you think, like, where would you draw that line? Do you have like a personal definition that you would use to judge where that point is, or you actually don't think that there is a point? It's like impossible to have a strict definition of it.
I think there is a point in the same way you can point to an exponential function and say that is the knee of the curve of the exponential. right? And it's like, yeah, like if you look at a graph, you can kind of be like, it's clearly there, even though mathematically you know that makes no sense. I kind of think it is like similar to that. Like I admit that in hindsight, there will be a point at which we say, yeah, it was here. But when you're riding that curve, I think it's very, very, very difficult to say which part of the exponential you're on. How zoomed into the exponential are you? Kind of a meaningless question.
I love that analogy. Yeah, that's a really nice way to put it. I'll tell you my definition of AGI. Yeah. And it's basically the ability, and I actually think I kind of go back and forth. I also think, I don't think GPT-4 is AGI, but there's times where I question it, and I'll tell you my definition. So it's the ability to generate explanatory knowledge. So I do think kind of the ability to, you know, make predictions about the future that come true is the definition of intelligence. And again, I just think about AGI as intelligence, not like consciousness, right? I think that's a different vector. I'm just purely talking intelligence. And there's some things I see with GPT-4 that I'm like, oh, it like has such an advanced reasoning ability. Like I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, I think something that this was one of your guys' papers that you put out, but it was asking GPT-4 to stack objects. And it's not trained on anything visual, but just using its reasoning ability, it was able to, you know, figure out that, hey, if I have like 3 eggs and a book and a nail, like this is how I, you know, this is the physics of it. And this is how I kind of stack these objects to kind of make them balance. That's explanatory. That's like almost there with explanatory knowledge, because it's knowing kind of the physical properties and it's able to make a prediction of if I put these things in this way, X, Y, Z will happen. And I'm like, I think we're close. I don't think we're fully there yet, but I'm like, I think, you know, give it another 1 or 2 versions. I don't think there's anything fundamentally missing from getting us there.
Yeah, I am. So, I mean, I think about my own, you know, like edge management job here. And, you know, you kind of tend to think that like that's on the further end of the kind of more human-y AGI type things. You know, at the same time, though, you're sitting there trying to like write a doc together, or hell, even like a perf review. And you kind of can't help question that whether, I mean, so GPT-4 today like clearly can't do it, but you do wonder whether or not it can't do it simply because it just doesn't have the right context. If it heard every conversation I heard, if it knew everything I knew, if it read everything I have read, could you coax it to arriving at nearly the same conclusion that I ended up like writing there?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel too far off from being able to do that today. This is why I think that kind of as when we like finally get in a lot of the, you know, like upload your private context, have it know your Slack and Drive and keep in sync with that and like browse in most recent histories and transcription and stuff like that. If you can like really like capture all of that, we might think very differently about what GPT-4 can do. It's actually kind of an interesting thing too, because here that feels like a precipitous jump, and yet that's not necessarily a change in the model itself. Like it's interesting you can get those types of qualitatively significant changes without necessarily having GPT-5 or 6.
Yeah, I completely agree. And kind of I can't remember where I saw this or someone told me, and it's now the way I approach prompt engineering. But pretend GPT-4 is a super intelligence, right? And it, you know, it's a genius, but it has zero context on the world. And so the only context it has is what you are saying. And so you have to be very explicit in your prompt and kind of really spell things out. And that's how I approach prompt engineering. And it's generally a good mental model. But I agree. It's like pretend it's just the super intelligence, but has no context. As soon as you start giving it context, I think pretty impressive things will happen. I think people's minds will be blown.
Yeah.
Do we have all the elements so far that we need to invent to get to AGI? Or are there kind of fundamental elements that we still need to invent to get there?
It's tough to say. I think there is definitely a lot of unknowns in terms of, like, if you push the scaling laws out, okay, we can, like, push compute further. We can buy bigger computers. We know NVIDIA's roadmap. We know, like, how to just, like, build more data centers. That's one thing. First of all, this is controversial in the field, right? Like, there's quite a few people that say you can't just, like, make it bigger. You'll just get more of the same dumbness in the same sort of ways amplified, but still miss the boat on some more useful construct of what intelligence means. I think that's entirely plausible. The other thing I think we've noticed is that the difference between what is practically useful from, like, a day-to-day perspective and what, say, an eval says still has quite a bit of divergence from it. Right here, GPT-4, perfect prediction on capability, right? Like, that was like the big thing about the paper. It's like, oh, we predicted the the loss of this thing ahead of time. But we certainly in no way, shape, or form were able to predict how the market would react to that, what applications would be useful and would not be useful, what would sort of work and what would work well and what, like, wouldn't work super well. Product market fit does not follow scaling laws, alas. Otherwise, then you really have something special.
Well said. Well said.
So yeah, I think that is where a lot of the kind of, like, unpredictability in this will come from. Is even if you have something that, I mean, yeah, like we GPT-4 effectively saturated benchmarks, so we need to kind of, like, think harder about that now. But and yet, it still doesn't quite feel like an AGI here yet. There's still a lot to explore there.
Absolutely, I feel like we could spend hours more talking about this. I love talking about this stuff. Let's maybe switch gears to a random set of questions.
Sure.
So you went to Olin College of Engineering, and actually that's where we met 15 years ago. And I don't know if you remember this, but I have a very clear memory. It was you and your parents and Megan. It was right outside the cafeteria. And the story is such a coincidence too, because, you know, your sister and I were both interviewing at Olin, which is a pretty niche thing. Not that many people get invited for interview weekend. And then both her and I ended up deciding to go to the Robertson program instead, which is also this really small cohort. And so we were classmates at Duke. But I am a huge fan of Olin. You know, if I hadn't gotten the Robertson scholarship, I would have gone there for sure. And I just think it's, you know, probably one of the top five engineering schools in the world. So for the audience, maybe can you explain, like, what is Olin College? And if someone's deciding where to go to college today and they're interested in engineering and STEM, should they go to Olin?
In short, I think so, yes. I had a great time at Olin. I think it's still absolutely doing, like, substantially helping push forward what engineering education means here. And if anything, in hindsight, has, like, felt more relevant, frankly. You know, Olin was founded on the precept of re-engineering engineering education, of a way to train engineers that weren't just doing problem sets and memorizing equations and staring at blackboards, but could work together in teams and do interdisciplinary projects and have a strong emphasis on user-centered design and entrepreneurship, as well as kind of the fundamentals of engineering across a bunch of different dimensions. This is also where I personally got really involved in the, like, Boston area startup scene. This was kind of, I think Olin itself has an entrepreneurial spirit to it, certainly, which I think made that type of entrepreneurial spirit match for me when kind of seeing other startups in the ecosystem. You know, there's a lot of things built into it to actively throw out the curriculum every now and then to try and, like, continuously keep that fresh there. And also the small environment is just, like, really conducive to being able to do something to, like, make a lot of change and sort of get a pulse of the community and things like that too. So yeah, I personally had a very good experience there myself. You know, in hindsight too, I've really found that that's a big, it's made a big difference when it comes to the way, like, modern tech and companies work.
Yeah, just for context, so Olin is pretty new in the grand scheme of things, as far as, you know, colleges and universities go. Franklin Olin, if you go to universities across the country. There's like Olin buildings everywhere. So he was this big donor. And then he was like, I'm going to put all my money into one school now and one college and start this new college that's kind of designed to train engineers for the modern age. It was this experiment and this college that popped up in like a tiny, you know, Needham, tiny town outside of Boston. And this, what class number were you? Like, what, was there a full, you know, set of freshmen through seniors when you were there? Like,
if there just was. So Olin's first graduating class was the class of 06. They actually had an early year, what they call partner year, that in normal world would have been a class of 05, but they all graduated together in 2006. That early 2006 class is like quite a few people that I've seen in tech now. I think also from that early class, Frances Haugen has been in the news recently quite a bit for her Facebook whistleblowing. So it's quite a, like for this, now mind you that these classes, I believe, are like roughly like 80-ish, 80 to 90 people total per graduating class. These are very small classes. There's 300 and change total all 4 years, only undergraduate classes as well. Also different things like the professors, there's no tenure system there, which is very, very different, of course, if you're like a professor in academia. So I would have been the class of 2010. I myself ended up graduating in 2011 because we took this year off in between sophomore and junior years for to start a little company there, and then came back to school. I also had a professor who taught both at Olin and also taught at MIT and invited us to like audit a bunch of classes over there. I actually ended up making this friend group because of that actually led to a lot of other of my future careers and paths later on too. So it ended up being a very strong network.
That's amazing. And yeah, I do feel like there's kind of Oliners everywhere, certainly in tech, but it's a small cohort of people. But you all are very impressive. And, you know, you've called out a few, but just really kind of have a big splash.
Yeah, the Olin network is tight. In fact, there are two other Oliners now at OpenAI, at least that I'm currently aware of. So one of them is Alec Radford, who I reached out to when I joined OpenAI, not because I knew what he had done, which is embarrassing in hindsight, but only because he was an Oliner, which I think says something about the like network here. It's like, oh, wow, there's another Oliner here. I'm going to like reach out to him. Alec was several years below me, so we did not overlap. Anyway, yes, Alec is really a force of nature at OpenAI here. Radford et al. Is GPT. So he's now a thing. There's another Oliner here. Luke Metz is here as well. Luke had a tenure at Google Brain and then came over and now runs one of our post-training teams, which is a really key and has been a key part of everything that is the ChatGPT model to this day.
Olin Network is strong at OpenAI and beyond, and the Valley, and just kind of, you know, tech and STEM in general. Evan, let's say someone's dream is to work at OpenAI. What advice would you have for folks who are, say, college students or early in their career today? How do they prepare for a career like that?
That's a good question. It depends on, so now OpenAI is like very varied in terms of like kind of has a lot of the different parts of a team and company. I would say on the research side, it's first of all, it's been amazing the scale and caliber of researchers people have been able to like get and pull from here. Their stories are quite varied. There are quite a few PhDs on the research side for sure that like really go in and specialize and do a lot of this as well too. Getting a lot of like real practice in industry, either through us, we actually have a residency program that's designed for that from the research side. I have noticed though that particularly the focus, we tend to specialize quite heavily here on specifically a lot of these like large language models now recently. It used to be more varied, but yeah, it is a lot of these like large language model type things, which I have noticed have diverged a little bit skill wise from say people who are building like ad classifier networks like 10 years ago. Like that type of data science has some overlap, but yeah, really getting into a lot of the like large language model stuff has been a more recent thing as well. The other skill set that's been actually fairly difficult to find is exposure to, like, particularly the, like, types of large models that require operating across multiple GPUs, multiple boxes. There's a lot of specialization in understanding these, like, Torch distributed primitives or CUDA kernels or, like, this NVIDIA stack, like the Nickel COM collectives, like, things like that too have been another, like, key piece here. On the engineering side, like, it's been the kind of, like, common theme here is a lot of experience building resilient, high scale, like, distributed systems, kind of all the engineering and, like, both from, like, an infrastructure perspective as well from just, like, a product perspective as well to make that happen.
Awesome. And so let's say someone's in college right now, should they be taking certain classes? Is it more about the side projects they're doing? Is it, like, hands-on stuff? Is it coursework? Like, what should their next year look like to prepare for a job at OpenAI? And let's say your team.
Yeah. So for a lot of the, like, engineering pieces, I think by far the most useful experience has been experience in industry. Mm-hmm. Through starting through, like, internship programs at one of the big tech companies, and then also just, like, having time at either large or rapidly growing startups to begin with. It's definitely a field that is has a little bit of the kind of, like, academic CS theory behind it, but just a huge chunk of kind of industry specific technologies and a lot of, like, industry specific experiences that you get when seeing systems and companies, like, grow and scale and things like that too. There's some nuance in there too. Like, I think all the big, like, the really, like, the kind of, like, Google size tech companies, they have a lot of the, like, problems and experience and programs like that as well. They use their own kind of proprietary tech stacks. It's not necessarily a huge problem. Being able to have exposure to kind of, like, both sides of things is a big deal as well too.
Basically graduate, get out there in industry, start getting experience building real systems and just, like, getting your hands dirty.
Yeah, for sure. Waterloo in particular has a very strong, like, kind of, like, internship and externship, like, program that tends to send people through a lot of, like, companies. By the time they get out, they, like, really have, like, seen how modern engineering teams just, like, operate and work and do things.
That's a great point. Yeah, Northeastern also has their co-op program. I mean, frankly, it's hard for schools to keep up these days with curriculum because things are evolving so fast. The goal of school is learning how to learn, right? But any kind of one specific skill set is just, it's hard for schools to keep up because it's hard to refresh the curriculum every single year.
Yeah, no, I definitely think the meta learning pieces are important. At the same time, though, I think the opportunity to do nothing but just learn something becomes increasingly rare as time goes on. The thought of having an entire dedicated block where your only job is to learn something new always seems like a bear at the time, but in hindsight is one of those, like, precious things to have at the other end.
Related to time, you had your first kid about 2 years ago and we're two on the way. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm thinking about, you know, whether or not to have kids. I think I want to have kids, but I also want to continue to have my foot on the accelerator career-wise. There's so much I want to accomplish. So I always love hearing from accomplished folks who I respect of how they've been able to kind of balance the two, balance the kids and the career. What advice would you either give for me or kind of for your past self about how to prepare and how to think about balancing kids?
It's definitely worth it, for sure. It brings new challenges every time in kind of their own unique ways. I will say one thing, though, particularly around the kind of, like, work and career side things. If anything, the forced rigidity of things feels like it has made me more ruthless and productive in kind of, like, prioritization. So very concretely, like, I don't have nanny care until 8 o'clock in the morning. And like, she needs to be relieved at 5:30 in the evening. I mean, if it's not a nanny, then it's like a school drop-off schedule, like something. Like, those are hard limits and they do not change. Of which point there are kind of other like responsibilities to deal with after the fact too. What that means though is that they're like, when I look at my calendar, those are the hours that I have. I think there, I had this propensity to sort of feel like the procrastination thing is like, oh, well, there's always some extra hour sometime in the middle of the night over here or in the evening over here. In reality, they're like, yeah, I guess there are sometimes some of those, but they're usually not, it's usually better to just like be more ruthless about focusing on what you're doing in the first place. And that sort of forcing function for me has been a very strict way to sort of prioritize what is and what is not getting done. Because if you like assume that you don't, that you like have a very finite amount, if you like really lean into the finiteness of time, which is true regardless of whether or not you have a kid, I think it's just like an important skill that has like been forced developed and like a lot of parents like need to do as well too.
And it's interesting because I always hear parents say that, you know, it's like having kids has actually made me more productive. How did you guys figure out childcare and hiring help, and what are some of the things that worked for you?
We actually are currently doing a nanny share, which is same nanny taking care of like two kids from one from each family right now, which we thought was like a nice way for our daughter to have like somebody there to like socialize with as well too. We are starting her in preschool as well, primarily for the kind of like socialization aspects of things. There are lots of like different ways people do this, however. They're from like daycares to full-time nannies of like varied years. It's like quite, it's like very wildly varied, even amongst people that I consider like nearly identical and like all on paper respects. Like the way people do this tends to be like very different and sort of suits their interests and needs at any given time too. I'd say another thing too is that the degree to with which people like have this impact their lives is also wildly variable as well too. I know some people for whom like they made absolutely zero changes to the way that they were living before and after kid. And some people who like completely like moved and upended all of their lives to like change things around this. So there's like a very wide spectrum in the way people handle this. But at the end of the day, like most people turn out okay. at least the risk factors are probably elsewhere beyond the optimizations of time and nannies, certainly. I think that's like a hugely personal decision that people tend to do. And like I said, that has varied wildly across even close friend groups.
Do you think there would have been a better and worse time to have kids? A lot of advice that I hear is like, hey, just have kids ASAP, the sooner the better. I am early stage startup founder. I do think there's like better and worse times and times that it's like worse. But I don't know. I mean, what in your perspective, like when you think back to your life, like were there better and worse times, or you think it's always hard and you just kind of have to make do?
This is something that is generally very difficult to time overall. I don't necessarily think there is like a perfect or ideal time. It's the kind of thing though that like once it happens, like everything else adjusts accordingly to it. So like if you're the type of person who just like under various circumstances figures out how to make things work, you'll figure out how to make things work kind of regardless of when the timing comes. I know parents that have been early stage founders in between careers, like people like make it work. One way or another. It kind of just depends on where time and priorities are. Now, I mean, at the same time too, I do want to be sensitive. There are very real like biological issues at work here. Some people have a very easy time having kids. Some people try for a very, 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 very long time through great expense and ire to do this as well. And unfortunately, that's definitely something that's not predictable ahead of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I'm thinking back, like when you were running your own startup, was that, you know, if you had had a baby then, like, would that have been, you would have made it work? Or like, that would have been.
So to me, that was actually less like a circumstance of like a startup and more a stage of life type of thing as well, too. If my entire social circle like only wants to rage from 1 a.m. to 4 a.m. because that's the stage of life they're in, then that's harder. Yeah. So I think if anything, the kind of a overriding factor tends to be those types of like the social networks, the stage of life type stuff. Yeah. Those are kind of major components for things. I do know people who take their kids to like Burning Man, but we are not, we personally would rather be asleep than like out clubbing every night. But some people like want to prioritize that more. And like I said, they just get a sitter every night. They take the kid. I don't know. People do like all sorts of different stuff.
Yeah. Good seeds to plant. I appreciate it. Okay, last question before we kind of do one final section here. So what AI paper from the past, let's say 6 months, has gotten you the most excited?
Yeah, something that personally I found really just thought-provoking. Actually, this is out of our own alignment team here at OpenAI, this auto-interpretability research. The basic idea here is having a natural language explanation for what every single neuron in GPT-2 does. And this is actually related to a separate paper that I think believe Anthropic published earlier, that they just like changed the activation function to make them more interpretable.
Interesting. I haven't seen that.
This has been an early thing. Like basically the idea here, we like to think of these things as big black boxes. To a certain extent, they kind of are. But at some level, like at the end of the day, you're just like multiplying numbers together here. I kind of view it with the same level of awe and black boxiness that you view, I don't know, like life itself, right? Like to an organic chemist, it doesn't seem that crazy. To a sociologist, DNA seems pretty in the weeds there and black boxy. So it kind of depends on the level of abstraction you look at it. But here, nonetheless, like much like we've been working to encode what every single ATGNC does, here is now a method to talk about what each and every single model weight might represent and a way to kind of like steer that. This to me is particularly important because one of the biggest problems in alignment has been, how do you know if it's lying to you? Are you a good robot? Yes, I'm a good robot. Cool. Okay. But, you know, if you can really inspect under the hood and like really at the weight level, like attempt to ascertain whether or not it is telling the truth or not, that might be a potential path forward out of that predicament. That's quite speculative at this point, but I think it's kind of like interesting. Nonetheless, this work that is about the kind of interpretability of these models, I think it also kind of highlights that I think we actually do kind of know quite a bit about what's going on under the hood at some level. But nonetheless, the rhetoric of these being black boxes is really pervasive and continues to be so today. I think this comes a lot also out of like a lot of the prediction systems, for example. Your feed news ranking algorithms and the networks that power those are quite opaque. Now, some of them actually do explicitly attempt to use human labeled features to be able to be interpretable in that sense too. So it's a little bit different, but you know, these models, you can also just ask them why they chose something, which is another kind of crazy way to get at this. But yeah, I think there is hope here in understanding what's going on under the hood.
Yeah, no, I agree. That paper is so cool. Basically having GPT-3 explain all the neurons in GPT-2. We'll link to the paper in the show notes. I don't know if you know the title off the top of your head. I'm blanking out on it, but we'll link it and folks can check it out. I'll also add that Anthropic paper that I don't think I've seen yet. So Evan, one of the secondary goals of this podcast is to kind of get the word out about my favorite book of all time, which is called The Beginning of Infinity by David Deutsch. And so I picked a quote from the book, and I would love to get your reactions to it.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is from a chapter that's actually called Optimism. And so I'll read it and then kind of get your reactions to it. We have a duty to be optimistic. An optimistic civilization is open and not afraid to innovate, and is based on traditions of criticism.
So I like that for a couple of reasons. So first of all, I would say I personally am long-term very like optimistic, but consider myself sort of short-term skeptical and pessimistic about things.
Interesting.
So I would say like in terms of the outlook here, I'm first of all, I am much more the Star Trek fan of the like next generation era. So I believe in this, in the like fundamentally optimistic look that that gives to humanity here and like technology's ability to like enable that over time. On a long-term sense, OpenAI is like fundamentally very optimistic about the future of artificial general intelligence, our ability to benefit all of humanity here and to broadly distribute its benefits. So to that extent, I also believe that like we can chart a path here, not doomed to the foibles of the past. At the same time, yeah, I think it is important to be like critical of what it takes to get there and the like pitfalls along the way. I'm also aware of how the broad mission of like connecting the world together is on one hand like a lofty goal, but as we have seen through like various social networks, has lots of unintended consequences in the fact. I think AI will absolutely have its own similar situations to begin with. There are lots of local fears that I absolutely have. I definitely worry about these technologies' abilities to what they can be done in the hands of an authoritarian surveillance state. Here we talk about the benefits of having good transcription and summarizing meeting notes and stuff like that. But if you're a surveillance state and you have perfect transcription and summarization over tapped phone lines, that's like a very acute problem today.
Yeah. What do you think about, I think the thing that was interesting to me in this quote is the criticism bit. What do you think about the culture of criticism, you know, in the world today? Is it alive and well in the world? Is it alive and well at OpenAI?
Yes. Both alive and well, and I think like a deeply important part of this too. Like it is important to have that criticism and skepticism for everything that is happening. I said like a lot of these things have unintended consequences. And I think if we're not introspecting that like brutally and honestly, it's very difficult to uncover those areas. I mean, to me, it's also the like essence of healthy debate of kind of like pushing this field forward, of like finding the pitfalls along the way. Yeah. Internally as well, there's a constant tension, as there should be, between getting something out there and doing so and like deploying it safely. Non-deployment has been is one of many like potential tools when it comes to like how do you constrain the use of these technologies. Yeah, these are always like and need to be in tension with each other.
Yeah. I totally agree that criticism is just critical for innovation and for kind of pushing civilizations forward. I do feel like the tradition of criticism in kind of an open and direct and kind of productive way is somewhat lost in the world at large today. There's plenty of disagreement in the world, but not a lot of like nuanced conversation. And, you know, I think a lot of that comes from social media. A lot of that comes from kind of business models around eyeballs and clickbait. I always love finding pockets where there's actual real kind of nuanced discussion and criticism and active debate. I'm a really big fan of the All In podcast because I think that's like one of the few places I found where they have kind of active and nuanced debates about stuff. But yeah, I'm happy to hear that you think criticism is alive.
I actually think this is an unintended consequence of having something like ChatGPT go a little bit more mainstream, actually, is that it makes it more likely that like a lot that like debate cycle will happen in places other than just Twitter. Like, I think if something is just being like bickered back and forth on Twitter, there's a certain amount of, I don't know, depends on the community. But yes, like the fact that like all the op-eds of all of the major news publications have like deeply and thoughtfully like pushed this conversation forward, both from the optimist and from the critical perspectives, and in kind of that pendulum swinging like balance here, I think has been a hugely important part of moving this forward. But at the same time, you don't attract the opinion sections of all the major news publications unless it's like something significant to talk about as well, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point. Well, Evan, this has been so much fun. Thank you so, so much for your time. And I look forward to catching up soon. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Edge of Infinity, an AI podcast. You can find all show notes, transcripts, and resource links to all of our episodes at blog.infinity.ai. I'm your host, Lena Avancini Colucci. You can find me on Twitter at Lena_Colucci. That's LINA_COLUCCI. Thanks for listening, and until next time.